It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists. With your host, Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
I'm Mark Kiesling, founder and CEO of the Da Vinci Pursuit,
where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Murphy, guest host and an arts and science enthusiast.
And today's conversation is focused on sacred design, geometry, number, music, and religion, the essential building blocks upon which all design is based. We have with us today three special guests. Please welcome Anila Aga, a nationally known artist. Hi, Anila.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
And we have Julia Arciero. Hi, Julia, an associate professor of mathematical sciences at IVUI.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you again. And Philip Goff, you're new to with us, an adjunct professor of religious studies at IUPUI.
Great to be with you.
Great. This is going to be a really fun conversation. So what got us kind of thinking about having this be a show was the idea that nature inspires things with number and things with geometry, the idea of, you know, one dimension, two dimension, three dimension come out of nature. The idea of shape and pattern, and that ancient people must have been looking at that because we see in a lot of religious works, particularly architecture and other things, we see a lot of these patterns coming forward. So why don't each of you take a little stab at it? Julia, so why don't we start with you? What kind of... Why are there so many of these number patterns? That's the way I want to start.
Well, when you mentioned this program to me, I guess two things popped into my mind immediately. One was, so there's the study of pattern formation in differential equations, or what are called reaction diffusion equations, where you can actually use mathematical equations to describe the pattern of an animal's coat, and how, like, there's a book about how the leopard got its spots, and like the size and dimension and how many, how the pattern is formed can actually be traced back to mathematics. So that's one thing that kind of popped into my head. And then the other thing that popped into my head was, the golden ratio, which I think some people may have heard of before. And this is something that pops in and out all the time. There's so many different ways, actually. And I think when you mention religion and things, it's even sometimes known as the divine proportion. And it's also seen in like seashells or different shell formation, things like that. But basically, it's a special ratio. And it's like the actual value is 1 + √5 all over 2. It's an irrational number. But this comes about also, like when I teach my students discrete sequences and things like this, there's something called the Fibonacci sequence. And if you've heard of that, it's basically a sequence of numbers where as you add them, so like 1, 1, 2, so 1 + 1 = 2, and then 1 + 2 = 3. So the next number in your sequence is 3, and then 2 + 3 = 5. So 1, 1, 2, 3, 5. So you're adding the two previous. So it's kind of like yn + 1 = yn + yn - 1. Anyway, the solution to that difference equation or the recursion relationship ends up being the golden ratio. And although I haven't studied it deeply, and maybe some of the other guests today can talk about it, but I have heard that it's because of the way the geometry of it, it actually is often found in architecture, in art, and even in music.
Wow, I think that's a really good description. And you're talking really about something that we've applied math to, right, Julia? In other words, we've looked at something in nature and then we have been able to do our construct of math and put that on there. That's
yeah. And honestly, golden ratio dates back to, I mean, the days of Euclid. So a really long time ago.
Wow.
Where they were discovering this special ratio. It's basically the ratio of, it's also, you can think of a ratio of sides of a golden rectangle, they call it, where like, if you have A and B, or if you have a square that's A by A, and then you attach to it a rectangle that's B by A, then ultimately the ratios of the sides, so A to B has to equal A plus B over A. So this ratio, if it's in a specific ratio, it's called the golden ratio, and that's also known as the golden rectangle. But this has been studied and observed for hundreds of years, which is really incredible.
Anila. Yeah, so, you know, you learned that in art school, I would think.
Yes, and I don't really remember it exactly the way Julia described it, but, you know, since I'm like math illiterate, unless I'm doing visual math, which is very good for me. But, you know, when I think about architecture and numbers or sacred geometry, I think, in a way, when you look at the ancient cultures, you can kind of tell that it is easier to develop a building based on, you know, the geometry of something rather than doing sort of like an organic kind of style of creating a building, kind of like the way it's just easier, I would imagine. And so maybe the ancient cultures kind of followed that because they paid a lot of attention to the natural environment. And so that's why we see more of that in ancient cultures than maybe now, because it's easier. You can kind of design on a computer and then translate that into different machine-oriented building materials and stuff like that. But maybe in ancient cultures, it was easier to do that.
Yeah, that's a good theory. Philip?
Well, Julia said what she thought of when she first was invited. It made me remember that when I first heard from you about this, about religion and geography, the first thing that popped into my head is, all I know is when I had a geometry exam in school, I would pray. I wasn't sure what I'd be able to bring to this conversation. I'm an American religious historian. That's my background. So I teach in American studies and I'm adjunct in religious studies. But you do see this in all sorts of ways. I'm an aficionado of Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture, for instance. And my gosh, yes, you see this very much at work there. And part of it, I think, is if you go even to his home in Taliesin in Wisconsin, you go into that room and the way he's got the beams going out like trees above you. So it's this idea of bringing nature into the building. So you're, even though you're inside, you're sitting in nature, and you can see that happening in sacred spaces over time, whether it's in Western Europe or you're in the Middle East. There is this sense of replicating the proportions and the sort of the repeated rhythms that you find in nature.
Sometimes I think that it may be because, you know, like when you repeat something long enough visually, it kind of gives you this, you know, sort of like a symmetry that is unlimited and it can continue. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about religious doctrine, it kind of makes you believe in something that may not truly be visible. Mm-hmm. And yet you're creating all these visual references to a god or to deities or so many different things. And I think in the Middle East or in South Asia, it was mostly about like looking at God and thinking about the unlimited possibilities of this being who has created this world. And so I think maybe that's one of the reasons in Islamic art you kind of see the repetition consistently. And often it's very geometric, or it's, even if you have organic floral kind of patterns, they're still within a geometric circle or a square or a rectangle. And it can be very fascinating to see that. And you know, if you visit some of these old buildings, you kind of are fascinated, or at least I am fascinated by how craftspeople were able to do that and create the repeats, where they consistently did it as similar as possible without the aid of computers. And so it's just fascinating.
Yeah, you know, I think, Philip, you hit on something, and Anila the same way. That idea that that repetition, the something about creating almost the infinite, or do you know what I mean? Like it goes on, and the pattern. I remember years ago going to the Exploratorium when Frank Oppenheimer was still in charge of doing that. And he was fascinated by a lot of those optical things. Like he would put, you know, glass Christmas balls together, touching one another, that were mirrored. Yeah. And they would create, he was creating all these boxes of infinity, of where the pattern, you know, kept duplicating itself. And I think we see that all through nature, but there must be something involved in not only the people looking and wanting to replicate it, but also why that created sacredness or a feeling of sacredness.
Mm-hmm. What I wonder is, I mean, I think human beings are attracted to symmetry. We're attracted also and really attend to certain patterns. Is there sort of like a co-evolution of certain sacred spaces that were created a certain way to be, you know, a repeating pattern or a symmetric structure, or also a architecturally stable structure that, you know, is attractive to us human beings, but also because we're so tuned into symmetry and pattern, whether it induces something like a sense of peace when we see it, which makes it even better as a sacred space, the feeling that it gives us. You think there's anything like that in some of this construction from ancient peoples until now of sacred spaces?
Well, I think about, if I may, are you guys
okay?
Yeah,
please.
You know, like if you go to the Notre Dame, you'll see the height there. The arches, the way the arches are, you know, like how they built around the rib of the building. And so they are very pointed, and it kind of, there's a specific name for the structure on the inside that caused the elongated effect, but it was also to kind of create awe in people, especially when, you know, you have the humongous arches and then the height of the building. And when you walk in, the echo of your voice or the sound of the music that was playing, the organs, it just created this sense of the sublime, I think, in people's minds. And if you think back on those earlier times during the, you know, the Middle Ages or whatever, people were generally fairly poor. There was a very big divide between the rich and the poor. And I think access to healthcare or education was limited. So I would imagine that people during that time were easier to kind of convince that this is God's presence, or, you know, this is a building that houses God, say, for example. And you see that also in Islamic architecture. Sorry, you were saying?
No, I was going to say, I think you're exactly right. And when you think back with Catholic doctrine and Catholic, the Catholic faith during medieval times especially, you had to go to that building to receive the sacraments. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's the Eucharist or it's marriage or rites, these are all baptism. Everything took place in that building. So it's the sense as if God's, you're going into the presence of God where grace is given through this. Mm-hmm. And the building had to match the importance of that sacrament to the people. And so when you've got, of course, this space which is arches up and it draws the eye up as if you're going to be looking up to God. And then on top of that, you have the windows, the stained windows particularly. Mm-hmm. Often those are repeating patterns. Many times, of course, they were images from the Bible or from a longer Christian story. And they were meant to teach. They were like comic books. The priest would actually reference you to look over at that window when he was giving the story of Moses crossing the Red Sea, for instance. But think of the light coming through that and how it would change the aura of the place as well, even through the day. So it would have a very ethereal feel to it, both for the architecture and then the light, the way it would come in as well, and the changing patterns there.
That's interesting. Julia, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and so I'm curious what you guys think with this history and the architecture and the thoughts that went into it. And now the architecture of current times, does it still incorporate any of this, or have we kind of lost some of that touch?
I sometimes think, and you know, if somebody else wants to go first, I can, you know, take a step back. But I sometimes think that contemporary architecture has kind of gone back to the individual taste and aesthetic of the person who may be designing something. And especially since we as artists or designers don't want to be put in a box saying, well, you're doing Picasso style work, or you're doing this type of work, or, you know, so each one of us is looking for a singular glory, so to speak. You know, we're trying to find a way to get ahead and be different enough that we don't, you know, get overshadowed by other people. And so it's become very individualistic, which may have happened during the Renaissance as well in Europe, I think. But some artists may use it. I use geometry because I reference where I came from, you know, and so in a way it's easy for me to start from that point, but I also love pattern. And so using pattern in tandem with what I am trying to convey, which is like cultural differences or contradictions, and yet we can exist or coexist in a smooth fashion if we wish for it to happen. And so I think like creating an environment where there is light and shadow, but it also kind of references nature, and it also references the idea that we are, you know, encompassed by nature, so to speak, but yet we are part of it, kind of allows me to create environments that help me to create a feeling where people become thoughtful. They become, in a way, they decide that, you know, they have to be quieter in one of those environments, and that allows for insight and retrospection or introspection. And I have noticed that people tend to be in a reflective mood, which allows them to have a dialogue with their neighbor. Whereas when we have something that's like disco lights and, you know, too much going on, we tend to become more fractious. Mm-hmm. And so it can, this type of patterning, the repeats and the, you know, the infinity of it, somehow lends itself to that kind of an environment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and part of the reason I asked this question was from a mathematical standpoint, you know, I like pattern. I like seeing symmetry. And if I see something that is purposely distorted and not symmetric, it rubs me the wrong way. It leaves me not feeling satisfied. And so I think to myself, okay, there's a lot of architects and artists who have built things over the years trying to use this golden ratio or whatever pattern to make it aesthetically pleasing, because they know how the human might respond to it. And so I think about, you know, people go all the time to the old cathedrals and the old things to see that beauty. Or we listen to older music and hear that beauty. And then in a day and age of today, I just feel like somehow we've lost, in some ways we've lost some of that, but gained in other ways. I'm not trying to be negative on today, but I think that there is definitely some level of that beauty and aesthetic in the pattern, in the underlying math, in those attempts to be infinite, to be reaching toward God, that is really awe-inspiring. So it's a really interesting topic.
That's really great. I think of all the different ancient, not even so ancient, but even recent past, when I go down to like New Harmony, the idea of there are things, that mazes that people create, labyrinths. Mm-hmm. And but even in the simple architecture of something like the Shakers did, simplistic form of that geometry, there was something. I think you all are hitting on that of that repetition, simplicity, and creating this kind of feeling there was something more than yourself. You were able to be transported.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, like, if you ever get a chance, there's a really beautiful museum in Houston called the Monell. And they have a wonderful collection of ancient sculptures and artifacts from Egyptian and Assyrian and Mesopotamian, even maybe Greek. And some of the abstractions that those ancient people were able to do with nature and human figure and kind of boggles your mind to realize that people were that smart, and we are still trying to kind of create, simplify elements so we can make it more abstracted, or, kind of reduce it to its essential elements. And, every time period maybe tries that, maybe every couple of hundred years, people want to go back to a different way of looking at things. But I think we always tend to, as human beings, go back to really, how can we simplify this? And when you simplify and you combine elements together, you can create an infinite pattern. And, Philip mentioned the windows in these Gothic cathedrals. What is really interesting in those windows, the stained glass windows, was that they had a story that was given through the glass, the colored glass, and the human figure and angels and all that. But there was an underlying pattern in it, so you combined an organic humanoid on top, and then you had an undergirding of pattern to hold it all together. And it was almost like referencing the world, in a nutshell. And I find that very fascinating in my own work, because I try to keep using that. I find it there are so many, and maybe Julia can talk about that, but there are hundreds and thousands of variations on it. I'm sure in math, that's how it may work, maybe.
Yeah, let's hold on to that thought for just a second. We're talking with Anila Agha, Julia Arciero, and Philip Goff. And you can join us in a few minutes after a short break.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Elizabeth Murphy.
And I'm Mark Kiesling. And today we're having a conversation about the essential building blocks of sacred design, with Anila, I'm sorry.
No, you're all right.
with Julia and Philip. And right before, Anila, you were starting to ask Julia a question. Can you restate that question for us?
I was like thinking that, you know, in math, I'm sure, and my father used to tell me this because he was an engineer and he had to, of course, do math. And I'm a visual mathematics person, so I can measure buildings, but I can't really. But I'm sure there are variations on the numbers and how many problems you can solve or how many equations you can create. And I'm sure it must be infinite in mathematics.
Sure. And you know, kind of bridging that math and nature aspect of things again. So, well, like I mentioned this idea of recursion or recursion relation. And so students that take one of my modeling classes learn about how one step depends on the next, or the next step depends on the previous step or steps. And so you have this recursion relation that you can end up solving it to see, well, if I start at a certain point, then where does that bring me? How does that compare to where I started? And you can develop kind of a recursive relationship in that way. And so that sequence I was telling you about, the Fibonacci sequence, kind of pops out really in a lot of places in math. But as you continue that sequence further and further and further, and you take the ratio of each number in that sequence, it's the golden ratio. It's really cool. And then, but there's other elements of things that you continue to solve. So, and I'm not a topologist or a geometer or anything like that. So I can't go into a whole lot of detail about some topics, but for example, fractals or the Mandelbrot set is again, really an image of a dynamical system. And people also have studies of chaos, but I don't know if you're familiar with just the picture of a fractal, but it's a really neat geometric picture that I think artists often tend to manipulate, as well as you see it in nature, like patterns of algae, or again, I think a lot of seashells, all these different types of just nature patterns that ultimately you can generate with math. So it is amazing that you can kind of match these things up, and then it's been studied for so long. But so Anila, I saw you nodded. Have you've seen fractals then in your artwork?
Yeah, and you know, like the most recurrent kind of pattern that I notice in shells, or you know, when I go snorkeling, or is often the spiral pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And then things are built around that in some mm-hmm. form or fashion. And that's, I find that also really interesting. You wanna tell
yeah,
us?
Yeah, I think, well, because if when you have this golden ratio and then what's called a golden rectangle with a certain ratio and aspect ratio of the sides with the square and then the rectangle attached to it, and you can keep folding down, and then drawing these curves where mm-hmm. you have a point of tangency to each mm-hmm. smaller and smaller rectangle that's established, that ultimately ends up generating this beautiful spiral. And yeah. I think that's more or less, I guess, that's what I kind of picture in my head when I think about the seashell mm-hmm. and what's happening with this golden rectangle. But certainly I think exists in a lot of other places as well. And then, yeah, if you were to zoom in on some of these fractals and the solution on one set, and then you see it gets smaller and smaller, but it's replicating basically.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So again, it's just a really cool image. I was a resident advisor back in college, and I always had to put like names on everyone's door. So I gave everyone a fractal background because I thought it was just such a really neat pattern. And I don't know, then they would remember me as their math RA, but it had their name on their fractal. And you just have all the infinite number of really cool patterns.
And I want to give a shout out to my now retired colleague, William Jackson, Bill Jackson. Mm-hmm. He taught in religious studies at IUPUI for over 30 years.
Yeah.
And he's written a great book on religion and fractals and how it shows up in art and architecture. So anyone who wants to know about sort of religious symbolism and how fractals have played into that, William Jackson is his name.
I just wanted to say, I just want to make sure anybody who might be listening knows exactly what a fractal is, because we might know one when we see one, but I think the definition might be a geometric pattern that replicates itself kind of endlessly at different scales and different.
Yeah, it's a great way of saying it, because you might see the original pattern, but then as you continue to go and zoom in, it kind of multiplies and gets smaller and smaller and smaller. I'm sure most people would recognize, if you saw a certain picture of a fractal, you would definitely recognize it. But yes, it's replicative, absolutely.
And how that, do we see things like tessellations or tiling, regular tiling in religious imagery or in nature? And how's that how would we know it when we saw it? What would it look like, tiling or tessellation?
Really a repeat pattern.
Just the same.
You know, I mean, like you kind of fitting it, you know, you kind of move it around like it's a tile, and then you can move it like this or like this, and it'll all fit together. And then you can keep adding to it, and it'll just keep growing. It can be linear, it can be vertical, it can be actually like a big, you know, most Islamic patterns are like tessellations, they fit together. But it doesn't have to be a single tile that would fit. It can be three different tiles, or it can be two different tiles. And, you know, in Islamic patterning, they have like an eight square thing, methodology, then a four square methodology, a two square, they're two pieces could fit together to create a pattern. And then you could repeat that. There are four sets, eight sets, six sets. So those make it why it's possible to create the infinite amounts of patterns with same similar elements consistently.
So, you know, when you bring that up, and Philip, you were, you know, you're talking about kind of the way things, when you go into a building, we think of the big features. But, you know, I'm now thinking that I need to start looking at floors. Mm-hmm. And the tiling, because I think there may be more intention to some of that than in the design.
That's a very good point. You know, Julia asked a while ago about how sacred spaces have changed, it seems like, over the 20th century. And they certainly have, especially among the Protestants. I mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright earlier, but of course, Wright's big axiom was form follows function. But of course, he still built with a certain, using these ratios and all still that we're familiar with. But if you go to these newer large mega churches, for instance, you're walking into an entertainment facility, basically.
Right.
The stage is up there set for music, and it's supposed to evoke individual responses. So I mean, Anila is exactly right that it's far more individual. It's about your personal relationship with God, not about the community any longer. But I was watching one the other night because I this is what I do for a living. And the building itself, the room was just awful, I thought. What if you looked closely, there was a pattern in the rug, actually, this red rug with the gold, how it came up each of the aisles and then had these various angles coming at each other up near the platform. So I think you're exactly right. That when we walk into some of these spaces, we have to look for the pattern and the repetition, but it may be under our feet. You're exactly right.
Well, it might be something we feel without even knowing we're
looking
for it, because we don't recognize these patterns. It may give us a feeling or direct us a certain, a forward or sideways direction in a church.
Especially with the Protestants, the idea is to get you to go up to have a religious experience. And those gold rows going up on that red carpet definitely were leading you up to the altar. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the Middle East, because of the weather and the climate being so different, and in South Asia or Central Asia, weather being very different, they often used tiles or marble tiles on the floors. And there they use this methodology, at least in South Asia, they use this methodology where the process is called pietra dura. And what they were doing was they were carving out areas in the marble to create this beautiful pattern. And then they would fill it with semi-precious stones or tile, different colored tiles or whatever. And it created this pattern that again referenced the infinity of God, say, for example. And, you know, in Islamic culture, God is never on the floor because you're walking on it, which is something to think about as well, I guess, because I think they were mostly referencing maybe the simplified form of nature, you know, like flowers or maybe, I don't know, pebbles.
I think the time, that's a good point. I think the times I've gone into like a mosque or someplace, often I'll see though it on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the tile's not on the floor for the reasons that you said, but it somehow made it up in a different place. That's really interesting. Julia, I wanted to ask you that, you know, when we started thinking about, this is something I did as a kid, and I'm sure all of you did, but you take a compass and a ruler, and then you just start making things. We call them geometric constructions. But there's only certain things that you can make sometimes. So like, I think it's interesting. One of the concepts is you can take a circle, and if you bisect it, you're only going to get 6 points, which it does that. Or if you take the same size circle and put it around the outside, you get 6 circles. And I wonder if, because of some of those, when people were trying to construct these windows, or they were trying to construct a design for, you know, a structure of a building, I wonder if they were also falling into a number pattern that was defined by the geometry.
Yeah, because they would have some geometric constraints. And then, and I think pentagons actually pop up as a pretty common polygon because of, I think again, also due to these ratios that you could have from the outside to what can be drawn across. But yeah, and ultimately, I don't know, sometimes I also think about, you know, as we think of nature, we can also think about human and biology and structure. So then I also think, and maybe this is the math biologist in me, but I also think about the structure of proteins and the folding and the shape and the dimensions there. And now, you know, in the middle of COVID, we're hearing about different strains and how the receptors bind and things like that. And so always having kind of this geometry issue or geometric constraint kind of falls around anywhere. I don't know if that answers your question, but certainly you have constraints based on the geometry of whether you're dealing with triangles. So if you have an inscribed triangle and then 3 other triangles that have the same area, or if you're bisecting, it even falls out in, and I keep going back to this golden ratio just because it seems to pop up everywhere. But so in numerical analysis, you can study different techniques of convergence. And so one could use what's called the secant method. Well, calculus students learn the Newton method for bisection to find a zero, and then, or the Newton method to find a zero or converge to a root. And then there's a bisection method where you continue to bisect to find your root. And somewhere in the middle of there is what's called a secant method. And it turns out the rate at which that converges is also the golden ratio. So it's really just interesting. It kind of pops up everywhere in almost every aspect of mathematics.
You know, what's weird is when you walk into a room, a lot of what we're discussing right now, the old Masons, the Masonic order would have known all of this stuff, right? And they would have been playing with the numbers, with numerology, with the Bible and all as well. So this has long tentacles into all kinds of other movements out there. And if you've ever been to the Scottish Rite's Cathedral in Indianapolis, that first, it was the original entrance. Now you come in off the parking lot, but the original entrance off of Meridian Street, it's a perfectly cubed room. It's 33 by 33 by 33 to represent the 33 years of Jesus. According to tradition, that's how long he lived before he was crucified. And when you walk into that room, it feels strange to walk in to a perfectly cubed room like that. And it's got high ceilings, 33 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And it's meant to be this sort of entrance where you're made to feel strange at first when you walk in. And then you go into the rest of the building, which is more along the dimensions of what we've been talking about with these ratios. So it's interesting how they play with numbers And so at some points, they would do something very different than what you would expect to give you this altered feeling as you go in.
Yeah, well, I remember.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, I was wondering if we'd bring this up because I remember touring a Masonic temple in Philadelphia. And it was interesting, right? Because they did. They had a lot of pattern, a lot of explicit things. And it was, it almost felt eerie the way they described it. And then they would comment that nevertheless, in every room they put in an imperfection because to remind themselves that man is not perfect or something like that. To which I think I posed the question, well, since man is not perfect, wouldn't there always be an imperfection anyway?
Don't overthink it. Don't overthink it.
I thought they were overthinking it, right? But that's just my opinion.
You know, when I start making a new design for one of my pieces, I sometimes start from a photograph, and I, you know, now that I've gotten used to taking photographs, so I try to do it like exactly right at right angle to the pattern. So when I'm trying to draw from it, I'm able to kind of do it. But what I've noticed over the last 5-6 years is that they were not perfect. The patterns are not perfect, but visually they look perfect. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to kind of see like two sides of a doorway that, you know, I may have taken a photograph and I centered it correctly and I took it exactly at right angles. And yet the pattern on the right may not actually fit the left. And it could have been that two different craftspeople were working on it maybe, and that's why it's different. Or maybe it was the same person, but because he or she may have been right or left-handed, it could have been a problem. I don't know. But yes, I agree that the imperfection makes it very interesting. But can I tell you guys an anecdotal thing? The first time I had a major show, I did these drawings that had like circles cut out in them with inserts, similar to the Pietra Dura that I was telling you guys about. And I remember I would leave imperfections on purpose in there. And so somebody from the public at that show discovered an imperfection and she came and she told me, do you see this? This is wrong. And I said, well, I do it on purpose so I can make sure that you're paying attention, and you are. She was very proud of herself and kind of sweet.
That's cool.
That reminds me of a teacher I worked with that taught math, and he said, I'm going to make mistakes. If you find them, you know, I'm going to give you a reward. He never intentionally made any mistakes, though, but it worked. It took me attention because they were all hoping they'd catch him, you know, in something.
I love being caught. It makes me so happy. I'm like, oh, good. They're paying attention. And it's very easy to make an unintentional mistake.
Yeah, exactly. But back to this idea, I really, you know, exploring it, I'm thinking there were also some things with the technology that would only allow certain things when we think about it. You know, modern, now we have all kinds of ways of working with glass. Glass is not as fragile, so we can cut it in complex circles and spirals, but mostly straight lines was about what we could do with older glass. And so you see a lot in that. I was thinking in stained glass, or even in where they people would build something, you know, that was an object like a box or something. Those patterns were constrained by the technology. And so while somebody could envision something else, they weren't. But that part got me thinking, Philip, when you were talking about, you know, there's the image of a person and then there's the pattern in there. And then I started thinking, well, there's also the pattern of the way that the wood divides the shape again, another depth of a whole different pattern.
That's true. It's as if you're looking out the window at it in some ways, right?
Yeah.
Good point.
So, you know, I'm hoping that for our listeners that you'll start going into buildings, not just religious and sacred buildings, but into buildings and start wondering if people have intentionally, you know, tried to do things to foreshorten something or make something smaller to do that. I know that when I went to with my wife to Falling Water, when you were talking about Frank Lloyd Wright, he intentionally in that thing made things narrow and tight.
Yeah, that's right. So that when you come through a space and you come out on the other side, it feels more expansive. His entryways were very short, in fact. And then, of course, the dining tables would have these tall backs to them, so that when you sit together around the table, it's almost like you're in a room that's closed off from everything around you. And he was creating space all over within spaces. Just really a genius, no doubt about it.
Right.
Yeah, he was. Mm-hmm.
Well, this program's made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission of creating a museum without walls, so that artists, scientists, and the community can come together for unique activities and conversations. And we'll be right back.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about ways mathematics, art, and religion intersect in both the physical and spiritual worlds. I'm here with my guest host, Elizabeth Murphy. Liz, there must be a burning question that you want to ask these guests.
Well, I was kind of wondering, do we fit geometry around what we observed, eons ago in nature? Do we fit religion around what we observed in nature? Or was it sort of vice versa? Where... we had a religion, or we had something we already had within us, and then we sort of saw it in nature. Which way did it go?
All right, I'll venture an answer, and I hope others will jump in. I won't go back to the ancient world, but this may be able to be something that you can stretch back further. Christians had taught for years that God reveals himself, and they use the male gender. God reveals himself two ways. One is in nature, and then the other is in scripture. So they talk about natural revelation and then special revelation. So they really did look to nature as revealing the nature of God, the personality of God. And it might surprise some people to know that even the more conservative Protestants, like the Calvinists, they would read astrology because they believed that God actually did reveal in the stars what was going to happen. Now, of course, modern Christians would say astrology is all wrong and that it's punishable, according to the Old Testament, by death. But they believe that God's hand was in everything, and God would reveal himself in nature, including in the sky. So from that sense, they really saw it as a revelation that then they would apply mathematics to try to figure out. And those things, especially all the way up through the 18th century, sort of stayed wed to each other. You could believe that God's revealing himself in nature and at the same time try to figure out how nature operates. So that's where you end up with sort of the Enlightenment God, basically, that God really... created, he put patterns in there to make the world work the way it does. And we see that very much in this movement of the sacred geography right now, that geometry, that there are patterns out there that undergird everything and that God has revealed in them. Well, the Puritans would have said, yeah, that's right.
But, you know, in a way, it also negates each other, doesn't it? Like, you know, when you start looking at the, you know, the way the world operates or the structures of different things, or math about it, or, you know, some of the discoveries that have been made over the years or over the centuries, it seems very, very plain to me, somebody like me who thinks about these things quite often, that they don't kind of gel together.
I know that this is where, I think this is where faith is kind of where, you know, if you believe that God is the God of all truth, whether it's truth in scripture and truth in nature, then those have to go together. But yeah, I mean, the Enlightenment eventually went far beyond the Puritans in this, and that, and you know, where we sit today is that more people, well, you know, we have to keep in mind that still 56% of Americans believe in the virgin birth. Yeah, so I mean, this is a highly educated country, and yet the majority of people still believe in something that is, you know, scientifically impossible. So people hold contradictory thoughts constantly, I think.
And my answer to the question, you know, follows kind of what Philip was saying, which is, when you see something, like I gave at the beginning of the show, I gave the example of how the leopard got its spots, or how many stripes a zebra has, or the pattern of its striping. So we observe that. I mean, that is something in nature. There's the animal. But then, oh, wow, we can actually show how that pattern could be generated via a mathematical equation. So in graduate school, one of my professors would say, you are all applied mathematicians, but the better word or better title for you is that you guys are all natural philosophers. And the reason he titled us with that was to say, you guys have the job of observing nature and seeing if you can explain it. Can you explain it with your mathematics? So like day one of grad school, we all, you know, we all got into groups. And for example, my group was watching the formation of a water drop. And I had no assignment given. It was, I had to ask the questions. I had to understand it and really see the formation and collect data and really try to understand, describe it, and actually become that natural philosopher. And really that's what a mathematician is doing. They're observing the world and putting mathematical understanding and pattern to it. And I think in essence, God is creating this amazing place that we have just a little amount of knowledge that we have to actually understand it. And we're keep getting, you know, chipping away at it, understanding more and more and more, but there's so much more to be understood.
Yeah. I think that the whole, the idea that these patterns are out there, you know, these things exist. And we, for our very survival as humans, had to depend on recognition of patterns, so that we could see what was out of the ordinary, you know, what was not supposed to be there, or see in something in nature, something that would be a predator hidden because there was a disruption in what it is. And I think that just kept on because we see patterns. I always laugh, you know, there was an episode of, what was it, when Glee was on, where he finds, you know, Jesus in a piece of toast or something. But or the cheese, I think it was a toasted cheese. Anyway, toasted cheeses, the name of it. But we can find these patterns, you know, and we have people all the time, don't we, Philip, where people, they will see something that I guess it's there, but it's of their own making, sort of. I mean, one would question.
You know, that's a long tradition, and American religion especially, this, we call it harmonialism, or the perennial philosophy, this impulse to try to find the one reality that's underneath all the chaos that holds it all together, that there is a holistic thing that ties it all together. And we all want to find the grand unified theory or something, right?
Yeah.
But the idea that we can look at this worldly phenomena and it corresponds to some kind of higher truth or higher reality. So yeah, I mean, I recall when I lived in Los Angeles before I moved to Indy, there was a tree that had been chopped down. And when they did chop it down, they thought there was an image, a face in it that looked like Mary holding baby Jesus. And suddenly winds kicked up and clouds came over. And I mean, all of Los Angeles was talking about it for about 2 weeks, about a tree being chopped down, you know, and then somebody saw something in it. But it's that impulse that humans have looking for this underlying truth that undergirds everything that will show itself in a tree.
So as a person who studies religion and, you know, obviously pontificates on it, you know, as a professor, I wonder how you sort of like think about that, like how do we explain it, you know, like that, yes, human beings and animals came from prehistory to now because they evolved. And then on the other hand, people are talking about 2,000 years old, you know, sort of religious doctrine that came from Christianity, or 1,500 years old Islamic doctrine. How do we explain this? Because, I mean, it often boggles my mind when you're kind of putting the data in front of people, or even yourself. It doesn't really equate.
No, I get where you're coming from very much there. This is, I mean, for me, I'm a historian ultimately. And so I study, for me, religious studies is a study of human beings being religious. And so they're gonna believe all kinds of things. I'm not gonna try to judge what is right or wrong or what's truth and what isn't. I'm looking at their human behavior. And there's no doubt about it. There's an impulse in people to try to look for this underlying truth that undergirds everything. And they come at it from all different perspectives, usually from whatever culture they've grown up in, right?
So then I wonder about this other thing. I'm sorry.
Now I'm going to cut in on you because we are having a great conversation, but we're running out of time. And I want to thank our guests. So Anila, thank you so much. And Julia and Philip, this is great. And our guest host, Elizabeth Murphy, for sitting in. And Liz,
you'll find pictures of their projects and those of other guests on the Da Vinci Pursuit website at thedavincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more connections from the intersections of art and science.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedavincipursuit.com. Or you can join your hosts, Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling, here every Saturday at 1 p.m. on A Different Kind of Public Radio, 88.7 WICR.